Owning a boat comes with a number of perks, like being able to fling your favorite fishing rod around. And here's another perk. GEICO's boat insurance covers your boat and your belongings. And with specialist support from agents that are as passionate about boating as you are, there's so much value that you'll want to high-five someone. But not while you're holding your fishing rod. That's a prized possession. So hold on tight with both hands and keep it covered through boat insurance. Get more with GEICO.
Hello. Welcome to the Latin American History Podcast, episode 122, a brief overview of post-conquest Latin American history, part 7, the Cold War dictatorships. Last episode we looked at the turmoil caused by left-wing revolutionaries, so now we must also look at the right-wing response in more detail. We've already seen how dictators had established themselves, usually with help of the military, in some countries before the Cold War started, and so they were not uniquely a Cold War phenomenon. This new global context, however, did of course impact their character in the second half of the 20th century. There were two main reasons for Latin American dictators to take an anti-communist stance. The first was that they were of course reacting to the ideologies of the people attempting to overthrow them. These were not always Marxists. Again, that Alan Wells interview episode I mentioned last time provides very useful context. But as the more extreme groups were more likely to use more extreme methods, of course, state reactions to this would take an anti-Marxist bent. The second reason was Latin America's place in the global Cold War context. Just as they did in parts of Africa and Asia, perhaps most famously in Vietnam, both the USSR and the USA jostled with each other through proxy wars. Once Castro's regime was established, Cuba also joined in on the side of the USSR. To make an oversimplified statement, the USA was happy to align with anyone who would fight the war against communism, even if that meant supporting dictators in the name of democracy. We saw a couple of episodes ago that dictators in the northern part of Latin America often towed a pragmatic line to obtain support from Washington. This continued and spread southwards as well. If the US was afraid of communism in its neighboring countries, and Cuba had made their nightmare come true, and furthermore, it was willing to intervene in far-flung places like Vietnam and Korea, then of course, the rest of the Americas would form part of its battleground. We have seen how Latin America's experience of the Cold War played out differently in different countries, from successful revolutions to prolonged civil wars, and how these outcomes did not really map out geographically. In the far south, however, there was uniformity in how things went. We looked at the story of the coup in Chile and how this brought General Pinochet to power. His rule is fairly typical of the experience of not just his country, but Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, Bolivia, and Brazil. These countries saw sustained military dictatorships, which were able to rule their countries with iron fists. Left-wing movements did exist, but they were consistently beaten back by the generals and could only dream of even achieving the level of power required for a Colombian or Peruvian-style conflict. These countries saw what have become known as dirty wars, semi-secret purges of anyone considered to be subversive or threatening. Primarily, these were aimed at left-wingers, whether actively plotting revolution or trying to create change through protest and workers' movements. But they expanded to encompass people like artists, musicians, writers, liberation theology-inspired priests, or simply anyone who had been named by informants. In the worst cases, these citizens were tortured and then disappeared, plucked off the street and never seen again. A couple of years ago, I went to the ESMA Museum in Buenos Aires, Argentina, and although I'm glad I went, it was truly grim. It's in the same category of places as the killing fields in Cambodia, the Rwandan genocide memorial, and of course, the World War II concentration camps of Europe. This had been a naval academy, in which a secret processing centre for the disappeared had been established, one of many across the country. It shows the conditions in which people were kept, and how, through torture, more names were obtained, turning the centre into an efficient, self-sustaining machine, generating a stream of people to pass through it. At the back of the building was a courtyard, where helicopters would land to collect those whose usefulness was exhausted, to be thrown into the sea. These dirty wars were particularly pronounced in Argentina and Chile, but they happened to varying extents in those other neighbouring countries as well. The dictators even came together to create Operation Condor, a secret pact to support each other in their repression. Many activists actually met their ends outside of their own nations, having fled for safety abroad, but unaware that the dictators were letting each other's security forces operate across borders. Operation Condor was backed by the US as part of its anti-communist campaign, as well as quite possibly France. As I mentioned, there were similarities between the governments of all these countries, but there were a few small features which marked them out from each other, and which are worth briefly mentioning. Argentina's experience was overshadowed by Perón. His ideology was truly unique, drawing from left and right, before eventually favouring his supporters on the right. In some ways, he was one of those earlier dictators, having risen from the military and participating in an early coup. He did, however, win elections, and he himself, / his wife, when he died in office, found themselves ousted by military coups twice. His second wife, Evita, became an international celebrity, and president herself for a time once he had died. He might himself have fulfilled Argentina's quota for strongmanism, had the coup which deposed Evita not led to the military junta which waged the dirty war. That junta saw Argentina ruled by a succession of generals and military councils, the structure remaining in place, but the overall leader changing. In this, Argentina resembled Brazil. In Bolivia too, the generals retained control, but they were not unified in the same way, and instead took turns ousting each other. In Uruguay, the sitting president actually asked the military to help establish a hybrid civilian-military government. But while figurehead presidents continued to exist, the military gradually solidified its control in the background. In Chile and Paraguay, one individual cemented control of the military governments: Pinochet in Chile and Stroessner in Paraguay. I have hinted earlier in this series that post-independence and the disastrous wars that followed, Paraguay will embrace its geography and look inwards, doing many things differently to everyone else. They did follow the pattern of a military general launching a coup and establishing a dictatorship, but this dictatorship, physically landlocked and surrounded by other dictators, was particularly free to consolidate power and use it how it wished. Stroessner gathered up more personal control than perhaps any of his neighbouring strongmen. He purged society's institutions of potential rivals, and eventually, those that remained came to him and said that they would collaborate instead of trying to outmaneuver him. He fought a war against the country's left-wing insurgency, and of course collaborated with his neighbours and the US through Operation Condor. For the most part, he seems to have enjoyed his country's relative obscurity and built an economy based on smuggling everything from drugs to cars and even expensive exotic animals across his neighbours' borders. Just as Colombia's civil conflict provides an emblematic example of left-wing insurgencies and the civil conflicts which sometimes resulted from them, I think that the dictatorships of southern South America are the most illustrative examples of the dictatorships in Latin America of the era. It should be pointed out, however, that similar strongmen ruled at various points across the region. So some of the trends we've just looked at apply elsewhere to varying extents.
Owning a boat comes with a number of perks, like being able to fling your favorite fishing rod around. And here's another perk. GEICO's boat insurance covers your boat and your belongings. And with specialist support from agents that are as passionate about boating as you are, there's so much value that you'll want to high-five someone. But not while you're holding your fishing rod. That's a prized possession. So hold on tight with both hands and keep it covered through boat insurance. Get more with GEICO.
So now that we have examined both the revolutionaries and the dictators, we have a good idea of the political situation of the Cold War era. There are, however, some loose ends to tie up. Firstly, there are a couple of interesting exceptions to the patterns of Cold War government, which we will look at. Secondly, I think it's important to quickly talk about two ideas which contributed to the shaping of Latin American left-wing thinking and added to the atmosphere of the time from an intellectual point of view. Whatever you think of them, understanding them is vital to comprehending the political mood in the region at the time, as well as, to some extent, today. So the first of those exceptions is Mexico. We have seen why this was in previous episodes. Mexico had its social revolution early, way before the Cold War. And after some chaos, once it had succeeded, the quote, perfect dictatorship had been established. And the institutional revolutionary party ruled into the 21st century. The country wasn't immune to Cold War politics, and its position on the US border made it particularly susceptible to anti-communist pressure from its neighbour. It had its own dirty war, targeting communists and students with disappearances, and there was a massacre of protesting students in Mexico City which killed hundreds. Despite some left-wing economic policies, such as nationalisation of the state oil company, Mexico largely kept the US on side, and it avoided both large-scale insurgencies and intervention. Panama took a unique path, partly because its canal was of such importance to the US. It saw a military coup in the late 60s, but the National Guard member who would consolidate power, Omar Torrijos, was not a typical dictator. To begin with, he preferred to be the power behind the throne, and never actually served as president, even though he controlled things in practice. He also didn't subscribe to the political positions of his contemporary military coup leaders turned dictators. He was more left-wing than right, and he was very popular amongst the poor and groups like the country's indigenous people, because he improved standards of living, and they felt that he came from their world, as opposed to the Spanish descended elite who had held power until then. He supported Allende in Chile and the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, but never formally aligned himself with the Soviet Union. He admired and aspired to imitate Nasser in Egypt, who had nationalized the Suez Canal and seen off the British in doing so. The parallels with Panama's situation were obvious, and he aimed to take their canal back. He was skillful. You would have thought that his politics would have made him among the top targets for US intervention. But he managed to avoid this and negotiate a treaty, which would see Panama take control of the canal in 1999. He was perhaps lucky here that Carter was in power in the USA. Many other politicians there were angry with the agreement. Torrijos died in a plane crash in 1981. This may have been just what it appeared, an accident, but it has sparked conspiracy theories that accused both sides in the conflict to follow. Some thought that the US had engineered it to consolidate control over the canal. Others, that it was the man who succeeded him, Noriega. Noriega was a longtime ally of Torrijos, and in some ways he was a continuation of the old system of power. He was one of several who assumed de facto power in the wake of Torrijos' death, but he manoeuvred the rest out and became the sole leader. Like his predecessor, he was never president, but he was the true power in the country. He was different, however, in that his political views were much less developed. He basically relied on his control of the military rather than popular policies. He had been a close ally of the US, being among their most important partners in Panama. Unlike his predecessor, who liked the Sandinistas, he offered to help assassinate their leaders for the US. Despite this, though, he did later have a relationship with the Sandinista government, but also with sworn enemies of the US, like Gaddafi in Libya and Fidel Castro. The reasons for US dissatisfaction started to mount up. The 1989 election became particularly messy when his candidate appeared to have lost. The US accused him of using the country as his own personal money laundering and drug trafficking apparatus. Washington wanted him to go, and they put pressure on him to do so. He refused, and the death of a Marine at a roadblock in the capital proved to be too much. The invasion, while only lasting a month or so, was a massive operation. Noriega was captured and spent the rest of his days in prisons in the US, France, and back in Panama. There's one final exception I think we should talk about. I think I've done a pretty good job of mentioning all the nations of Latin America in this series, using their stories to highlight how they exemplified or formed an exception to the general trends when relevant. There is, however, one country I don't think I've mentioned at all, Costa Rica. There is good reason for this. That is, that relative to its neighbours, almost nothing happened there. Today it's probably the most stable and one of the most well-off Latin American countries. And this, combined with its ecology and beaches, has made it a haven for tourists and expats. During the colonial era, though, it was one of the most distant and forgotten parts of the empire, ruled from Mexico City, but as far away from it as it was possible to be. The Spanish system of direct trade with its colonies and prohibitions on trade between colonies meant that it couldn't even integrate with its also remote neighbour next door, Panama, then part of the separate northern South American viceroyalty of New Granada. Its small indigenous population hindered its development during the encomienda period, as it limited the labour pool. It was underpopulated and often overlooked. It was included in, but peripheral, to questions and wars about whether Central America should be united or split up. And while it did suffer liberal versus conservative wars in the post-independence period, these were muted compared to its neighbours. It saw some growth and immigration in the 1800s, and two military coups slash civil wars in the first half of the 20th century. The victorious party in the second of these, however, put the country on a different path to its neighbours. In order to prevent the risk of another military coup, they abolished the army, gave up power, and established a democracy which has lasted to this day. From its humble beginnings, then, it has done extremely well and avoided most of the problems and turmoil which has influenced the direction of other Latin American countries. Given its avoidance of many of these problems, you have to conclude that the fact that Costa Rica has not really got a mention in this series is a good thing, for Costa Ricans at least. So finally, onto those last two political ideas I mentioned earlier. While most of the political positions and trends we have looked at today are strongly connected to the rest of the world, these two ideas were distinctly Latin American. The first links back to the idea we talked about last episode, that alongside actual military interventions, Western economics, and the activities of its corporations, the idea that, alongside actual military interventions, the Western economic system and the activities of its corporations constituted what proponents called neo-colonialism. In the 1960s, a concept called dependency theory was developed by Latin American social scientists. This economic analysis separated the world into core and peripheral countries, corresponding to today's division between the global North and the global South. It holds that the global economic system is not designed to stimulate development through the markets, but actually to enrich the core countries at the expense of the peripheral ones. The peripheral countries, which included Latin America, provided not just cheap resources and labour to benefit the core, but also a market for those core countries to sell the products made thanks to those same resources. Thus, the core countries are enriched and the peripheral ones remain poor and never get the full value of their resources and labour power. Meanwhile, dependency theorists argue, global economic institutions, such as banks and even aid agencies, are designed to maintain this status quo, rather than fulfil their stated aims of developing non-core countries. Perhaps the most famous piece of work which advances this view is The Open Veins of Latin America by the Uruguayan Eduardo Galeano. The other movement, which was born in Latin America at this time, is liberation theology. We have seen that the Catholic Church was often a conservative institution in the region, forming that alliance with the Crown during the colonial period, and ending up in conflict with the revolutionaries in Mexico. In Spain too, whose 20th century history has many parallels with its ex-colonies, the Church was often closely associated with General Franco and his dictatorship. The official Vatican position towards life, society, dictatorships and civil wars in Latin America was not particularly involved. Some of its priests, however, took a more engaged and subversive view. Faced with poverty among their parishioners, and influenced by the wider political climate, they reinterpreted the Bible from the standard position as a cry for social change. Jesus, they argued, was not a rich man, and his message was one of liberation of the poor of Judea, and so by extension everyone else. They pointed to Bible passages which they believed showed that his primary concern was for the poor and downtrodden, and that he made a nuisance of himself to authority. He was, they argued, a revolutionary who was killed by the state for his revolutionary politics. This interpretation of Christianity found popularity across Latin America, and was embraced particularly in countries like El Salvador, where Bishop Oscar Romero was shot while saying Mass for his advocacy. Nicaragua, where liberation theologists helped to shape the ideology of the Sandinistas. And Colombia. There, a Spanish priest actually led the ELN, one of the country's biggest guerrilla groups, and one of its most famous members was a priest named Camilo Torres Restrepo. In 1968, 48 priests signed the Golconda Statement, which explicitly called for an uprising to overthrow what they called the ruling classes of our country, through whom our foreign dependence is maintained. The legacy of these political conflicts still impacts Latin America today. Like the rest of the world, however, the fall of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War brought big changes to its politics. The era of left-wing uprisings and right-wing military dictators was, for the most part, at an end. The next two episodes, the last in the series, will look at the most recent decades in Latin America, and the time where history merges into contemporary news. If you've enjoyed this episode and want to do something to help out, one thing which helps new people discover the show is leaving a review wherever you get your podcasts from. A huge thank you to everyone who's already done this, and thank you to everyone for listening. You've been listening to the Latin American History Podcast, written and recorded by me, Max Argent, edited by Alex McNamara. If you've enjoyed the podcast and want to get access to extra episodes, you can become a friend of the podcast. There's information about how to do this in the episode description. The podcast is also available on YouTube by searching for the Latin American History Podcast. If you'd like to send me a message, or if you have any questions, you can email me at historyoflatinamericapodcast@gmail.com.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.